When you visit Arizona, time is measured in moments, not minutes. Like the moment you see the Grand Canyon for the first time. Visit a new state of mind. Learn more at hereyouareaz.com.
Everyone goes, oh, why didn't he call me? I was like, because no one's thinking about calling nobody at the time. They're fucking in it. They're in it. They're in this crisis moment where everything is fucking fuck the world. Fuck it, you know?
Let's go.
Welcome to Citizen. We've got a special guest today, Vincent Rocco Vargas. You may have heard of him. How's it going?
Good, man.
Welcome to Texas.
Thank you. Thank you. I got back as fast as I could.
Back from where?
You know, we were in Utah for a while.
Yeah.
About 7 years. But when I went to Utah, I was living in El Paso at the time still.
But you didn't live in, did you live in LA?
No, I never did. I did the commute the whole time. Yeah, you know, all 7 years of that.
That's not bad.
Or 6 years of it, yeah.
That's not bad from Utah or Vegas or something like that.
No, no. The drive was 9.5 hours. And sometimes the drive, if I chose the drive, it was just like audiobooks and podcasts.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. What kind of podcasts you listen to?
You know, I listen to Joe Rogan was one I did for a while. I've done the Jordan Peterson. I enjoy his stuff. Drinking Bros podcast from time to time.
Well, you're an emeritus drinking bro, I guess, is what you would call that now at this point.
Yeah.
So let's go through your history a bit. I want to start from the moment you were born.
Yeah.
Where'd that happen?
In Northridge, California, in the San Fernando Valley.
In the valley, huh?
Yep.
Valley trash. I get it. I like it, man. It's hot as fuck down there, though.
It can get hot.
Good Lord.
Man. I didn't know any better, bro. That's all I knew, so I loved it.
What was it like growing up there?
It was cool. You know, from the age where I started to really understand where I lived, it was obviously like kind of a gang environment. You grew up really fast knowing what colors you should and shouldn't wear and things like that and what streets are kind of the dangerous ones to go down to. But I was so heavily in sports that I really didn't, you know, I didn't partake in any of that. You know, friends maybe, but me personally, I never was a part of that world.
Well, how do you manage to circumvent getting involved in that shit? I mean, because it's pretty attractive. What was your home life like?
Was it was good. You know, stable? I have my mom and my dad, bro. Mm-hmm. You know, so my
that
mom
helps.
And dad, man, my older brother. My father was a former gang member, but he was back in the day wasn't gang banging. He got in trouble with the law, so he ended up going to the Marines. My brother was involved in the world of it, started from tagging, got into the music scene of it all, and kind of became a pretty big well-known name in like kind of the Sudanio movement, if you will. But I played so much sports that I didn't even have time to be involved in that. Weekends were baseball tournaments and whatnot. And, you know, my father was pretty heavy-handed in the fact that I could not step outside of that I can't fuck up much. And if I thought about it, I always thought about, like, the ass whooping I'd get when I got home.
Yeah, I mean, he's not a professional fighter, but definitely involved in professional fighting.
Right? Yeah,
I mean, he's
absolutely.
Pretty well-known cut man, one of the most well-known of all time, actually.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you don't want to fuck up there.
Yeah, it wasn't uncommon to see my dad get into his own scuffle, right? He was willing to fight anybody. And growing up watching that was like intimidating as a man to feel like, man, he has no fear in fighting anybody. I don't think he'd question punching me. And he never punched me, but like it was always the fear, you know?
Yeah. Do you think he had no fear or was it like, because I wonder about, because I feel that way too. It's like, my principle means more to me than my fucking safety in life, frankly, I think.
No, absolutely. You know? And I think, like, if the table is turned, my kids probably think the same of me, I'm sure. But I don't know. I've never seen him. He's kind of that generation of, like, men don't cry and fucking tough, tough, that even when his mother passed away, he read the eulogy and didn't even shed a tear. Like, he's just a kind of a tough cookie to crack.
Yeah, yeah. And what about your mom?
She's the dreamer, man. You know, I talk about my mom, she was raised very poor. You know, her mother came across the border and circumvented the system in a way that the book talks about. But my mom, she was raised poor. You know, for Christmas, they would get a used toy. It wasn't uncommon for her to help in the fields and picking cotton and fruit. I believe it was, I can't remember exactly which fruit it was, but that was just how they grew up. My grandfather would jump on the trains from Texas to Arizona to work in the migrant fields as well. And, you know, they were a hardworking family, but she at 18 decided she didn't want to continue that cycle with her family and work in a cannery or the fields or whatever. whatnot. And so she moved to LA to be, you know, she became a secretary, you know, and, you know, my mother and father, you know, my dad was a firefighter. And so he was home, you know, a couple of days of the week, and the rest of he was at the firehouse, and my mom was the rest of the time when she was probably working most of the time. So, you know, I would come home from school and kind of fend for ourselves in the sense of cooking dinner at times, unless she was home. But if she wasn't, we would figure our meals out. We would kind of do our own homework, and I'd ride my bike to baseball practice. And so it was kind of an autopilot lifestyle for a while until we kind of got older, and it is what it is.
Yeah. What about the teen years, right? You're getting a little more independent. And we're the latchkey kid generation, right? Both parents, yeah, for the first time in American history had to work,
yeah,
all the time. Not that's not always the case, but it became the majority, I think, yeah, in our generation when we were growing up. So it's like, I remember those days. I had a lot of autonomy for a fucking retard. You know what, yeah, I mean? Like, I had way too much responsibility over my own life for the, yeah, amount of emotional intelligence I had at the period. But, you know, that's kind of how you got to do it, right? It's like if you were a different species and you saw a mother bird push her baby out of the nest and learn to fly, you'd be like, man, she's kind of a dick. That's just the way it is, right?
Yeah, I think I tried to raise my older kids in the same way. But, like, at 16, I had the keys to the city, man. I had my car, and I was expected to get myself to baseball practice, expected, mm-hmm, to get myself to school. And there was games that were easily 2.5 hours away. And I'm driving at 16 with a fucking map, dog. You know what I mean? And
like, MapQuest directions.
Yeah, dude. And so it was such a different world where I was trusted to do that. And there was nights when I was 16, 17, I didn't come home. And I just called my mom and said, hey, I can't drive. She goes, why? I was drinking. Mm. You know, she's like, okay, we'll talk about it in the morning. But, you know, the morning came around, like, I just got home safe. She's like, thanks for being responsible. Mm. You know what I mean? My father's like, would probably say something a little bit more aggressive. But at the end of the day, it was like, I wasn't, you know, they kind of knew, it was, as long as I wasn't getting arrested, I wasn't in a gang. They knew I was playing sports and traveling all over the place. And so it was kind of a, you know, I was kind of free floating.
Yeah, it's like, I think when people think of having principled parents, they have this, and I'm from the Southeast, so yeah, there's a different idea of it down there. It's like, yeah, the Southern Baptist clans, they don't think like drinking and smoking and swearing are their big no-nos. Not that, yeah, that is even mentioned in their Bible at all, right? Right. Nobody cares about that shit in the text, but it's like, that's just kind of the form that they're, let's call it their guidestone or their bumpers. Yeah. Took, you know what I mean? It's like, you got to have something to keep you on the straight and narrow, for lack of a better phrase. People have this idea about what it means to be, I guess, a leader in that position. It's like, well, how could this person that's got a bunch of fucking tattoos, or, and then I'm mapping it onto present, you, yeah, know what I mean? How can this person that makes fucked up videos about people's buttholes and shit be a good parent? You know what I mean? It's just like, it's, yeah, none of that stuff is relevant.
Right.
You know what I mean? It, yeah, just doesn't, it doesn't matter. So I see, like, a guy that was involved in gangs and then the Marine Corps and then, you know, still walking around with a chip on his shoulder, still raising a kid that was more or less responsible, right? I mean,
yeah,
it's, well, it tells you a lot about how human beings operate.
Yeah, it was, you know,
like, coddling a young man is bad news.
I don't agree. I still to this day don't agree with it. Like, there's things I won't do. Like, I don't believe in, like, the full on hitting my kids at, yeah, all. Like,
I mean, there's just no, yeah, point to it.
Right. Exactly.
It doesn't work. If it worked, maybe we could, dude, have a conversation about it. It just doesn't work.
I tried it. It created a lot of animosity between, yeah, me and my oldest daughter because, yeah, our oldest son, because I thought it was the right thing, mm-hmm, you know. And as I've evolved as a parent, I've kind of, like, I'm an idiot. I was just continuing the cycle, right, of what my dad did and what his dad, mm-hmm, did. But what my dad did raise me with is manners. My daughter, yeah, the other day just asked, she goes, dad,
yes sir, no ma'am.
Yep. No. My daughter just asked me, she goes, dad, why do we say yes sir and no ma'am, or yes, no ma'am, yes sir? And she goes, most of my friends don't do that. I was like, well, there's a difference between us. Like, the manners to me is very important. Mm-hmm. It's a foundation that I really believe in that'll help you in the future. And just because they don't do that doesn't mean it's okay. Like, I 100% will not back down to manners.
Yeah, that's some, yeah, I mean, for me as well. Like, my dad was super, like, not aggressive punishment, but abusive, like, big time. Yeah. But that's the one thing that I did take from it that I'm glad that I learned was was that, like, whatever message you have or whatever circumstance you're in, think of manners as lubrication for that. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, things just go a little bit better,
yeah,
if you're polite about them. And there's no reason to be, especially if you're trying to actually make a point. If you're a cunt about it, nobody's going to listen.
Right.
And why, yeah, would they? Why, yeah, should they, right? You haven't taken the time to be a decent human being. So why should they listen to what the fuck you're saying? You know what I mean? That seems like a pretty simple lesson.
Yeah. I try it. My son, he's 14 years old, knucklehead, makes all kinds of mistakes, right? He's just doing it all the things wrong right now.
I remember being 14.
And I'm like, look, bro, I could be the dad that's all the way over here and I could beat the hell out of you, right? Or I could be the dad that's all the way over here and not care.
Yeah.
I was like, but I'm in the middle. And so that's the guy you get, the guy that's in your face saying, hey, dude, you know you fucked up. Let's own it. Let's own it and let's fix this shit. Because he's like, Dad, why do you always say that? I was like, bro, because I want you to admit when you fuck up so then we can fix that. Because if we don't do that, there's no growing from that.
Well, how much of that came from your upbringing and how much of it came from being in the Army? Because the Army phrase is bad news doesn't get better with time, right? I tell people that all the time. It's like, look, you got an issue I need to know immediately. I'm your fucking squad leader. Tell me, dude.
Right.
We can go fix it right now before it becomes nuclear.
Absolutely.
But if you sit on it, you're fucked.
Yeah, I think, you know, my father wasn't the type that was going to explain why he spanked me. I got in trouble and I knew I was fucking wrong and, you know, he would correct it. As I got into the military, I think it's where I started to learn like how to explain that to your subordinates because it was explained to me. And I think that's something I've carried on from the military to my kids is like, let me explain to you where we're fucking wrong, where we're off the rails and how to get back on it. And it's going to be brutally honest to the point where like, hey, you're wrong. Let's fix that.
Yeah. What made you decide to, so you're in high school, you're playing sports. I knew you were a baseball player. I was a baseball player as well. I just kind of lost, like I looked at the path, the trajectory to become a professional baseball player. I'm like, I'm not doing that. It's just like, it wasn't that I thought it was too difficult or anything. Cause I threw like 94 my junior year and I just kind of lost interest in it. You know, it was like, this doesn't matter enough to me to go be a professional. It made me feel a certain kind of way. Like that was around the point 16, 17. I was like, I don't really care about anything I'm doing right now. Right. It doesn't affect me. Like I still love watching baseball, but I didn't care enough. I knew I didn't care enough to put the kind of effort in that was required to be at the elite level for that. So I was just like, all right, I'm just not going to do it. I'll just be a fan from now on and let somebody else do that. But what was it like for you? Because you were a pretty good baseball player as well.
Yeah, I loved it. I still to this day, I have like a thought of like, I could probably still go throw a good inning. I would, if someone called me today, like, hey, we want to draft you, I'd be like, bro, I won't let you down. That's how much I've always loved the sport so much and felt so much passion towards it that I have trouble even trying to coach my kids because I feel like there's so much disrespect going on the field all day long, right? Yeah, I love it.
Even in Major League Baseball, the fact that nobody can bunt or run the bases anymore drives me fucking crazy.
It's just the kind of the nerds got a hold of baseball and started getting analytical with it and kind of destroyed some of the beauty of it. And that sucks to watch. It's like the same reason why catchers are not catching like they used to. And it's just a whole different ballgame when you start adding the analytics to it.
So what was it about? What happened during your latter high school years?
Yeah.
Did you go right into the military after high school?
No. I did junior college. I was in junior college for a couple of years. I didn't get the grades, not even so much grades. I didn't even pass an SAT to get a college scholarship. So I went to the junior college route hoping to get drafted out of junior college. I got in trouble the first college I went to and ended up going to a second college. That college was a blessing. It was a Glendale Community College out in the Glendale, California, obviously. And we're considered the Hall of Fame team of the school. It was the best career, the best season they ever had at the time. Fernando Valenzuela Jr. was on the team. He was the first baseman for us. We had a couple dudes drafted on that team. But, you know, I wasn't as fortunate as some of those guys get drafted. I continued to play. I got a full ride to I went one summer up in Chico, played for the summer, got a full ride to an NAIA college in Kentucky, and eventually became academically ineligible and lost the full ride. And so during that time, the war had already started. I'm sitting like on the weekends, I'm at Buffalo Wild Wings drinking beers or Texas Roadhouse drinking beers, watching the war on TV. And I started to kind of feel like, man, I'm going to miss out on something that's so iconic. I kind of want to be a part of that. Had a daughter already being born and no more baseball. I tried out for a couple of independent pro teams and I had an offer to go to Germany and play as well, but none of them would let me like bring my daughter along with me in overseas. And so kind of the decision was like, well, fuck it, let's just join the military. Mm-hmm. And if I'm going to join the military, I might as well try and do the hardest fucking thing possible in my head. And so I joined with a Ranger contract.
So you wanted, I mean, it's this is a classic American tale, right? You wanted your Hemingway moment.
Yeah.
Everybody wants it. I want to go off to war and do something important with my life.
Yeah, I really thought, you know, I've always felt like I was destined to do something special. I always feel it in my heart, you know, and thought like, well, fuck, maybe I'm going to go out there and be a part of one of the bigger missions, you know, that the world, you know, needs or some shit. you get out of the military fast and realize, like, fuck, I didn't have that moment I was looking for.
So you, I like asking people this question, and it's not that the answers are very disparate, but at what point during or after your service did you realize that what we were doing as a country globally didn't make a lot of sense, or that it, like, there was huge potential for blowback or whatever your opinion on it is?
Yeah, it was interesting, man. I think right away when I got in, I started to try and understand, like, wait, why the fuck are we at war right now? You know what I mean? And start to kind of dig into it. And but every time I was overseas, I stopped really thinking about that. I was like, well, let me just get out of this first, and I'll think about that, right? Let me worry about staying alive, and then when I get home, I'll really dissect this idea. It wasn't until after I got out of active duty, I was like, fuck, man, I hope to God this never... it doesn't feel like this was in vain, because you lost friends, you know? Still to this day, I think, you know, with all the blowback of pulling out of Afghanistan and the way it all went down, it felt ugly. It felt like, man, a lot of people died, and it almost felt like, was it worth it, you know? And I try and shake that off real quick to just think, like, well, in that moment, we were there for each other, and that was the value of it. But yeah, I start to, you know, the more you read about the government, understand the government, you start to really question, like, fuck, man, how many times have I been pulled in the wrong direction because of the belief or the driven of, you know, the emotional drive to pull you into that kind of fight? Still to this day, like, if my kids asked to join, I would still say, like, is there something you can get value out of it that's not, like, in the infantry space or combat arms? Then I don't see a problem. Mm-hmm. But the combat arms, infantry side of it, it would be a hard time for me to allow my son to do, not to say allow, but I would be like, bro, I personally don't feel good about that decision. Because within the first deployment, dog, 45 days into getting to Ranger Battalion, I was in Afghanistan on the top of a fucking hill, pulling a fucking, you know, a fucking, whatever the fuck, a patrol base. And I kept thinking, like, fuck, if I applied myself like I am doing now in anything in the civilian world, I could be just as successful, right? I could have paid my bills. I could have paid for my daughter. So I started really questioning, like, dumbass, you could have done so much in the civilian world and had the freedom to kind of do whatever the fuck you want. So I started feeling like the constraints of the military not give me the freedom to kind of create, you know, do more.
Sure.
So yeah, that shit was hard. That's, I think that was that, and losing a couple friends made it feel like, let's go see what else is out there.
Maybe you had to, though, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, maybe you had to. Maybe there was no other way to learn that of your own internal strength, right?
Yeah. I never would have figured it out unless I went to the military. Yeah, right. So I needed that push to know that there's so much more out there I could do.
And it's real. It's really problematic. And it, look, this has been going on since language has been around, maybe before. But, you know, people in positions of authority weaponizing the patriotism and empathy,
all right,
you know, of the working class to essentially extract wealth from either our population or other populations, right. Sometimes both. Lately it's been both, right. It's like I'm I've been working on a piece for Newsweek recently about what they're calling the recruiting crisis. I don't think there's a recruiting crisis, right? I think there's a crisis of identity in the country.
Right.
Like, who wants to fight for a country that doesn't give a shit about them? And you can say, like, all the parades and all the thank you for your service bullshit, but brass tacks, right? How are we treating our veterans? Are we treating them in any way appropriately? The answer to that is obviously no.
Right.
So it's like, if I don't have kids yet, but if I did, I would tell them no fucking way you're joining the military right now.
Yeah.
And that's a problem, right? Jared and I were talking about it the other day. One of the biggest losses are legacy members.
Yeah.
Like people like we were back in the day, right? And it's the reason a lot of people went to sign up for Vietnam, even though that was a fucked up war. Korea as well. But, you know, fathers and grandfathers were like, you're going to go serve your country.
Yeah.
And that's just not the case anymore.
No, not at all. It's actually kind of like that hard thing to hear is that people don't believe in America anymore. Mm. You know what I mean? Because the lack of trust in the government and whatnot. I still feel like, look at, so take it from me, for instance, I never would have been able to get college paid for. My parents didn't have that kind of money. We had four kids, right? One of us got the choice. The rest of us were like, if you figured out yourself in the future, you know? And so I never would have been able to get college covered. I wouldn't have the benefits if I didn't serve. And so I know that there still is value to the military. But like I said, the combat arms side is really hard pill to swallow. Mm-hmm. If you're doing it for like medical, as in like a medical professional, whatever the case, there's all these other jobs and support. There's still value for those lower class, middle class that need that one step to kind of jump kind of like, you know, socioeconomic positions. Yeah. It is valuable in that sense if you see it that way. The fear is that all of a sudden you have a fucking medic on top on a Top Gun all of a sudden. Then you're like, fuck, this isn't what I signed up for.
Yeah man. It's like there is a we know about the moral injury from war, right? Yeah. Like we have to do some fucked up stuff sometimes. It's going on in Israel right now. I should a lot. You're going to hear quite a bit of propaganda from both sides of any fight. But I don't. I know people in the IDF. They don't want to go fucking massacre civilians.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That's just not. And yeah. That's not who they are as individuals. I don't know anything about larger groups of people, but individual people I know don't. They just don't think that way. But sometimes shit happens. Yeah. You know what I mean? In war, you can't predict that. If it's a kid, it's one thing, but if there's a woman pointing a gun at me, she's gonna die.
Yeah.
If there's a woman pointing a gun at my buddy, she's gonna die. That right. sucks, man. Yeah. You know what I mean? But she's not an innocent civilian. I don't want to armchair quarterback anybody because shit's all fucked up. But the point is, you get involved in these situations, then you know sometimes you're gonna end up doing some stuff that you didn't want to do.
Right.
And you need to know a couple of things to be able to survive that. You need to know that your country and command have your back.
Yeah.
And you need to know that it was for a good cause.
Absolutely.
Like World War II, no question, right?
Right.
Like that's a pretty easy decision to make. The last 20 years, I don't know that anything I did was right,
right.
at this point. And I think a lot of dudes feel like that. And then yeah. you're talking about before you put it out of your mind when you worry or wonder if it was worth it or not. But a lot of people can't do that.
Yeah. It's tough, man. But yeah, the moral injury of it, I think that's why we do have such a massive amount of people committing suicide, mm-hmm. right? They don't heal those ideas and thoughts. I always tell people, like, I was completely comfortable with taking the fight to the enemy. What I never expected was the collateral damage that happens doing that.
Mm-hmm.
When you see, you know, innocent people get killed just by the tertiary effects of whatever that sticks with you. And those are things that I've carried for a long time. And those are the things that I work on myself really as much as I can and try and kind of guide others to do the same, like with those retreats and things that I'm doing, because that's the shit that sticks that you don't even think about. That's the moral injury of like questioning and trying to find a way to justify what happened there is something that like being like, someone who I don't talk publicly too much on it, but the fact that like I'm a follower of God, right? My whole belief is like, then you stand like, do I have to answer questions at one point? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I'm not getting St. Peter going to be like, hey, bro, what the fuck?
Right. And I think it's a big reason why, like, personally, my fight has always been like, well, let me become a medic later in life because mm-hmm. I felt so, like, I guess, compelled to try and heal or help other than being a shooter.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. I mean, one of the phrases I like to use is that if you can turn your pain and suffering into empathy for other people, you can save your life and their life, yeah. right? That's how human beings were designed to operate. We're social, communal creatures, right? Yeah. We depend on each other.
Right.
Even if, like, and all the aphorisms that surround that, whether they're positive or negative, like misery loves company, that doesn't sound great,
no.
right? But it does, it might be the most poignant example of how much we do need each other.
Right.
Like even in our most shitty times when we don't want anybody else around, we do still kind of want somebody else around. You know what I mean? And then you can tell when somebody is in what I call like a psychological death row and they don't want anybody around. That's when they're in real trouble.
Right.
You know what I mean? Because you're starting to sever that connection with other people. And that's mm-hmm. what we do when we get back home. Like when we're in a fucking squad base somewhere or in a team room, easy enough. Like I can say anything in front right. of you people. When I go back home and I'm working at fucking Indeed or some shit like that, I can't tell people what I'm thinking because I'm not going to be working there much longer.
You have no idea who has the relatable experiences. Mm-hmm. And the relatable experiences is what I think where connection comes from. Be like, oh shit, you know exactly what I'm going through, you know? And the fact that what we do when we get out of the military is we alienate ourselves just from the fact that we feel that people don't understand us, which for the most part, they really don't at in a certain stance, right?
Mm. Well, how could they?
Right, exactly. You know,
this episode is brought to you by ghostbed.com/drinkitbros. Ghostbed. It's the best bed in the world. It's the most comfortable. Sheets, pillows, the whole thing. I've got them all, man. And, you know, they wanted to extend their best possible offer to Drink It Bros. They've been with us for a very long time. So this is the email they sent us. We want Drink It Bros to get the best offer, so I updated the code for 50% site-wide. That's 50% site-wide. Use the code Drinkin' Bros. Drinkin' Bros with no G. For 50% off site-wide, everything that you buy on this site is going to be 50% off. Again, they get the best pillows, sheets, mattresses. They get the mattress protector. If you're sloppy and spill things and you don't want to jack up your mattress, they have pretty much everything you need. They've got weighted blankets now. They've got the adjustable base, which we really like. I've got one in my home. So go to ghostbed.com/drinkitbros. Use the code drinkitbros for 50% off site-wide. And don't forget about their pay-as-you-go plan. If you're with approved credit, you're going to be able to pay this thing off over the course of 3 to 5 years for $25 to $35 a month. It's nothing. Go to ghostbed.com/drinkitbros today and use the code drinkitbros for 50% off. This episode is also brought to you by blackriflecoffee.com, the best coffee in the world. As a matter of fact, they won both the gold and bronze medal at the Golden Bean Awards this year for their exclusive coffee club entries in the elite category. So the best coffee on earth, literally, was Circus Bear by Black Rifle, one of their ECS. So I recommend that you go sign up for the Black Rifle Coffee Club. Use the code CITIZEN. You're going to get those points off. And, you know, you get all the benefits from being in the coffee club. You get the free shipping. You get access to all the partner deals. You get access to the exclusive coffee club. You get access to any new products that come out before anybody else does. You know, it's a very large club that they have over there. And the coffees are premium. Every single one of them is good. You're going to get experience for you. You can do just the plain coffee club. And if you want your two bags of espresso or your two bags of silencer smooth or whatever it is you drink, you can get those two bags or one bag or whatever you want every month. Or you can use the ECS, the exclusive coffee club, and get access to some of the most premium coffees on the planet and kind of learn what it is that you like. You know what I mean? So then you can order those premium coffees from Black Rifle as well. So, and we all know they got the best branding, the best merch, and they're buddies. You know, we're all friends here. We love Black Rifle. So go to blackriflecoffee.com, sign up for the coffee club, or buy something. Do whatever you want. Use the code CITIZEN. You're going to get those points off. This episode is brought to you by firstform.com/citizen. Free shipping on all orders over $75 when you use the link. And you're not going to spend less than $75. I mean, they got the best products in the world. Especially the OptiGreens. You know me, I don't eat vegetables because they're fucking pointless. So I supplement with OptiGreens 50 from First Form. It is precisely formulated green superfood powder meant for overall immune system support and digestive health. It's really good, aside from just getting the daily greens into your body that you need. And make sure, by the way, you're taking this with MCT, because you have to take anything like this with MCT. 80% of your immune system is located in your gut and your digestive tract, right? So healthy digestion is essential for overall health and wellness, not to mention that most of your serotonin, I think 96% of your serotonin or 94%, is made in your gut as well. So you're going to be in a better mood. You're going to feel better physically, and you're going to feel better mentally if you are taking these greens. OptiGreen 50 has 50 chosen ingredients, effectively dosed. It's not necessarily how many ingredients there are, though, but it's about the right amount of each. Taste and texture like no other product in the market. It's not gritty. It doesn't have a weird flavor. It's got sweet berry flavors, actually. 100% of the greens are all grown and manufactured inside the United States, and they are bioavailable. Now, they've got other products as well. They've got the Microfactor, which you see behind me on every show, and I take them every day. You know, you got essential fatty acids, CoQ10, you got all the stuff you need in one little packet for your daily vitamin pack. And you mix that, you make yourself OptiGreens 50 shake, and you take those pills with it, and you're gonna improve your life precipitously. You're gonna feel better, you're gonna look better, so on and so forth. So go to firstform.com, that's 1STPHORM Shopify.com/citizen. Use the code. You're going to get free shipping on all orders over $50.
And I'm not here to wish anyone have my experiences either.
Yeah.
So it's just really, you have to find your group, I guess, that helps kind of, and you want to find your tribe that people talk about. But my other fear is like sometimes that tribe is what fucking also brings you even further down.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, yeah, if you let it, you will rise and fall to the fucking standards of the company you keep. Yeah. That's 100% true.
Yeah.
But it, you know, that's a challenge, right? It's like, you're a leader.
Yeah.
I'm tired of hearing somebody's got to do something.
Right.
If you're fucking somebody, get up off your fucking ass and do something.
Absolutely.
And harsh words, but I only say it because I've been there. Right. And that's what I needed to hear at the time. You know what I mean? And it's why people who have been abused make the best abuse counselors. It's why people who have been addicts make the best addiction counselors, because they are living in both of those worlds all the time. Yeah. They are... for the rest of their lives, probably processing the emotions and trauma or whatever the fuck that happened during their negative situation, but they're still carrying on and living their lives. They are the GPS coordinates back to a normal life, for lack of a better phrase.
Right.
And, you know, I feel like I was so burnt out when I got out that it was like, I'm taking this uniform off. I'm going to go do something else. And it was almost symbolic. It was like, all right, my responsibility is done. And that was wrong.
Yeah.
And it sent me fucking spiraling, because that's not what men, like, we need the purpose to survive, man.
Absolutely.
Like, and I was fucked for a while.
Yeah. I was very fortunate to have to pay bills still. Like, having kids was probably the thing that saved.
People think that's crazy, right?
Yeah.
It's like, oh, you fucking, like, no, these weird circumstances that I guess buttress your life, and you think of them as like a fucking pain in the ass sometimes, that's what saved you.
Saving, dude. I had to fucking pay. My innate like pressure to take care of my kids was what kept me so busy that I almost couldn't even pay attention to my own post-traumatic stress.
Yeah.
I almost couldn't pay attention to my own issues until later on in life. Things slowed down. I was like, oh, fuck. Like when I met Matt and JT, it was probably the best time of my life to meet them, because I was actually starting to really struggle, because I wasn't as busy as I wasn't trying to gain a new career. I wasn't going through these academies. I wasn't, you know, I actually was settled into a career field, and I almost was like, fuck, I'm exactly where I'm supposed to be, and I'm fucking miserable.
Yeah.
And it was just like, luckily I found someone at the time that I needed.
Well, how did you contextualize it at the time? Like, you're in a position, you're out of the military, out of relative danger, and you joined BORTAC. You were on the trail for a while too, right?
Yeah, I was. Yeah, I was a drill sergeant. I actually got activated while I was in the Border Patrol after my first year. I was a Border Patrol agent, got activated back to go push troops down to Fort Sill, Oklahoma for a year. And then I came back, tried out for BORSTAR. I was in BORSTAR. I was the medic attached to BORTAC. But yeah, tried out for the selection of BORSTAR and made that. And then eventually got laterally promoted back to go help with the TAC Med program at SOG.
Okay.
And that's when everything kind of slowed down, and I was like, oh, fuck. I'm exactly where I want to be, but I'm completely miserable with my position in life.
Why do you think that is?
I never took the time to actually try and fix me. It was like I was drinking and passing it up, and I was gaining ground on my career and everything, and eventually I got there, and I was like, I was at the top of the hill, right? I was at the top of the peak of like finally to get there, and I thought it was going to be like, oh, life is good, and I realized real fast, like, oh no, I'm still a fucking miserable piece of shit. And it was just like, you know, the fact that, you know, these two friends came into my life in the time, and we were all kind of going through the same phases of our life where we were all just drinking and kind of fucking trying to figure it out. It was like that misery loves company. I think we all were connected by the fact that we were all going through the same time.
Yeah, that makes sense. What do you think it was for you that turned it around ultimately?
Yeah, I had a counselor that did an EMDR session on me. We did a couple of those, but the counselor, she actually lives close to here. She's in Round Rock. Her name is Tanya Glenn. The first thing she said to me was, fuck your feelings. I don't care about your fucking emotions. She goes, it's something in your brain that I want to work on. And I was like, well, fuck, that's a different approach. Cause I've done the fucking group shit, and I was like, fuck this, I'm out. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's stupid.
Yeah. And so the fact that how she addressed it felt like kind of the alpha version of the communication I needed. And I was like, okay, fuck it, I'll sit here and listen to this. And she ended up going through what it was, and I said, fuck it, let's do it. And when we did it, it was the craziest thing that came out. She's the one to identify, like, you're struggling with being a shooter and a healer. And she goes, it seems like you've had this conflict for so long and it's eating you alive. And I'm like, you're fucking right it is, right? You know, because I didn't realize I was a medic. All of a sudden, she goes, "Oh," she's kind of breaking it down for me. And so she was healing this, you know, in one of our missions in Mosul. You know, I witnessed some shit that I fucking wish I did, in a sense, was just the collateral damages of war. But I kept having a vision of some lady in my dreams, and one day she would be disappointed in me for shooting whoever, her husband or whatever, in the dream, right? And then the next day she's asking for my help to heal this husband. And so, like, this dream was so, it was the same turn of a corner, and then boom, she's there. And every time I was driving in that dream, I was like, fuck, here it comes. And that the emotions that I had, I'd wake up completely broken. Because, like, I didn't want to keep seeing this fucking lady. And one day she hates me, one day she needs me. Both ways, I can't help. And it fucked me up, dude, for so long that I was trying to drink myself to sleep. And a lot of my life around me was falling apart. My second marriage, which, you know, that one was falling apart. And I was like, fuck, this is dying too. But it wasn't anything, anyone else's fault but mine. I was just ruined inside, and I wasn't connecting with anything. And so that's when I first realized, like, fuck, this doctor pulled a lot of shit that I didn't realize I was dealing with. Mm. And that's what started the path of, like, well, let's see what else is out there.
Sure. Yeah. The lady was you, right? The lady in your dreams is you.
Yeah.
Just struggling with your own fucking identity in the world.
Yeah.
Who do you want to be? I mean, it's not a bad thing to be a shooter, I don't think.
No, absolutely not. I think that's part of, like, who I am as a man. Like, I am the protector of anything I can't protect, right? If something happens today, I'll stand up and protect and die for it, and I'm completely cool with that.
But that instinct to protect was weaponized in a way that wasn't appropriate.
You know, absolutely. I
mean, that's hard to deal with.
Yeah.
It was hard. It was hard for me to deal with as well. That's the thing that made me the angriest, I think. It's like, how fucking dare you take this honor away from us? You know what I mean? Like, that's all you have at the end of the day after doing fucked up shit is, you know, to retain your honor and your identity. Is it had to be worth it.
Yeah.
And it had to be the right thing to do.
Justifiable, man. It had to be justifiable in our souls, dude.
And they robbed you.
Yeah.
They robbed us collectively, a lot of us, of that shit. And, you know, this isn't the first time that we've had a suicide epidemic, right? So after World War One, suicide epidemic. After World War Two, same thing. There was the, you may find this surprising, maybe not, but in the period, the years between World War One and World War Two, and then the 8 years after World War One, after World War Two, the rate of suicide was 3 times higher than it was during the actual wars.
Oh shit!
Yeah. So it's like, and then we find now, like, we're on pace for an active duty suicide record right now in the DOD. it's interesting to me that 30% of those suicides are people that have never deployed before.
Yeah.
Right.
That's the crazy thing that's happening right now. And I can't even begin to understand what the fuck that's about.
Well, we know you can infer some things though, right? It's not unique to just the experience of combat.
Right.
It's not that. I mean, it's, and then you draw that upward a little bit to the next least common denominator. It is, you're a man. It's mostly men. You're a provider and protector. And that has been taken away from you.
Yeah.
And, you know, then if you look at broader society, there is a constant barrage against masculinity for some reason, you know,
right?
What I mean, you can draw your own conclusions about why that is or why it's not. I don't really give a fuck about that, but it's definitely happening, you know. And it's
super odd times.
It's weird, man. And then there's obviously the hardware is fucked up too. Like, our testosterone's fucked up. We've these weird things we eat in plastic bottles and shit like that are killing us. But either way, it's not something that's unique to us. But we are the people that survived it. You know what I mean? We're like, I don't know how to put that. You know, we're the old wise people at this point. You know what I mean?
at least
with regard to how to handle this situation. But nobody's listening to what we have to say about it. They're still they are still running these group fucking circle jerks. They're still, like, using teenage rape counselors to fucking counsel men who have been in combat. That's not how this works.
Yeah.
It's not how it works. There are some facets of it that are similar, but to return identity to a man after their identity has been lost, you have to begin with their purpose. Like, what is it that you're going to do?
It's something that I work on. It's funny. I'm doing my master's in psychology because how much I work with veterans in the same exact field. And I've studied it. I've watched it, you know, the whole thing about suicide contagion and all these suicide prevention programs who ended up causing more suicide because it's almost the negative psychology behind always talking about the worst case scenario instead of how do you mitigate suicide? Well, teach people how to live well-rounded lifestyles, but also like, give them the tools to manage themselves when crisis kind of, you know, how do you divert crisis essentially? Yeah. But
it's that 5 to 15 minute window where somebody's sitting there thinking, and then it's like, oh shit, you know what? I left the oven on. I better go turn it off. And that's the end of that fucking suicidal ideation period. It literally happens that quickly.
Yeah, it's wild. Everyone goes, oh, why didn't he call me? I was like, because no one's thinking about calling nobody at the time. They're fucking in it. They're in it. They're in this crisis moment where everything is fucking fuck the world. Mm. Fuck it, you know? And, you know, that's one of the reasons why I became sober is because, you know, having some, Neil killed, that crushed me, dog.
Yeah.
When Neil's was one of my good buddies and he's not the reason why I went sober, but he's just kind of a fuck, man. That dude has similar deployments as me, similar life as me, and fucking to me, he's fucking on top of the fucking world. He's killing it, right? You know what I'm saying? And then to hear he took his life was a hard pill to swallow, that a lot of our dudes who do take their own lives have been drinking. It's kind of like that fuck it button, right? Mm-hmm. Just like before you kick in the door and you're like, I might get shot in the face, fuck it, boom. You know, same as drinking. I think drinking is that one thing that a lot of guys kind of need to be like, fuck it. Mm-hmm. And it's and I had a few friends that did the same thing. And I said, you know what? Fuck this. I don't want to give myself that same reason because life is life, dude. There's shit happens in everyone's fucking life. So I don't want to have alcohol in my life to be the conduit to me to say, fuck it. And so that's the reason why I've removed alcohol from my life as well.
It could be a bad recipe, I mean, combined with the other stuff that's going on there. I mean, it's one of the biggest problems is that we're not afraid of dying.
Yeah.
Like, we already faced that fear. I don't give a shit about that anymore. It's like, that's something that's going to happen at some point. What the fuck am I going to do about it? I think, you know, the fear of death, the fear of injury is what generates adrenaline and cortisol so we can go fucking defend ourselves or defend things, right? So it's good to have a bit of a pucker, I guess.
Yeah.
But, you know, when you get back into relative calm and you don't have that, like you're in fight or flight mode, but it isn't a defense mechanism anymore. Right. It just, you're stuck there, right?
Yeah.
And in the same way, you can be in a very successful position in your life and feel miserable. You can be in a relatively safe position and feel unsafe. You don't know what to do about it, man. That fucks you up. It fucks your head up badly.
Yeah, I was always fear that, what was I going to do to fuck up this situation next?
Mm.
You know, and I always felt like I was almost trying to defend myself from myself.
Yeah. And then you don't have, there's the fight isn't there.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, what the fuck am I even fighting anymore?
Right.
People will go find something. You know what I mean? We'll find something, even if it's ourselves. And that usually ends up being the case because we isolate and then we just beat the shit out of ourselves physically, emotionally, whatever. It's rough, man. And it's not, again, we talk about veterans a lot, but it isn't unique to veterans. I mean, these issues were going on in the fucking post office back in the 1980s. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like this type of this and primarily with men, same situation. Like we think of this new generation, Xennials and their mass shootings and shits. Like, this didn't start going postal, happened way before Columbine, bitch. You know what I mean? Like, so that we know a lot about the kind of stress environments and lack of care for people that are doing tough jobs that lead to the shit like this.
Yeah.
And we still manage to fuck it up every single generation. But you know, the people I'm worried about our active forces. I'm worried about our veterans. And I always will be because we're just like there's a lot of us, yourself included, that are doing a lot to try to solve this issue, but it's a big issue. but even our approach is still too narrow in scope. Like, who's talking to, you've got this new book, Borderline, about the border where you used to work. Who's talking about CBP employees who are not getting time off right now? They're getting, they're capped out. Everybody in CBP that's a fucking actual 1811 or 18, whatever the fuck, they're all capped out on pay. They can't get paid anymore. So they're just getting time off but not now.
Yeah.
Right. they're getting time off that they may be able to cash in at some point down the road.
Yeah.
We're fucking grinding these people into powder right now.
Yeah, they have one of the highest suicide rates per capita of any law enforcement right now, too. And right, I get, look at all the stuff they're dealing with, but not even that. All the scrutiny they have with them on the media that makes them look like they're the fucking bad guy.
There's no, like, nobody likes them.
It's the weirdest
thing. The government hates
them,
bro. The people hate them.
It's the weirdest thing where the president himself was, like, mad at the dude for the non-whipping is what they call it.
Yeah,
right? But it's like...
That's a very Brave New World way to say that, too, isn't
it? Well, it was weird to me because I'm like, wait, you're the one who put in the policies, right? Your people create the policies, and how Border Patrol apprehends anyone is based on what the policy is. And there is these small dudes that might pull, like, step outside of that. But that incident itself was, like, proven, like, to be 100% exactly what he was trying to do was his job of apprehending. And you do grab people. And for them to almost attack him instead of, like, further investigate was hard to watch, because I was like, yeah, that's why the Border Patrol feels, like, demoralized, because the people who are signing their checks, the people who put in the laws that they're supposed to be protecting are the ones who are also demonizing them, which is fucking crazy to watch.
Yeah, that's wild, man.
It was why I wrote the book.
That would be like that would be like Bush Cheney deploy us to go do goon shit overseas, and the whole time, like, man, our guys are just a little too rough over there.
Yeah, you know, yeah, like, right. That's what it felt
shut
like.
Shut the fuck up. What are you talking about?
Right. I wrote the book, and swear to God, I saw that shit, and I saw how it was handled. I said, yo, Jocko, I'm writing this book, dude, because too many people, we're in a really weird time where people just receive information and take it as facts. Still, it's like really weird, right? Yeah. Like they're just like, oh, yeah, like, especially my mom's era of, like, she believed the news, trusted the news, and now you can't trust
shit. Facebook,
yeah. Yeah, she still is like, oh, my God. But people were demonizing them so fucking bad. I had tons of agents hit me up like, bro, I'm leaving. I'm getting out of this career because people don't understand it. I'm like, yeah, dude, because everyone is demonizing you. And I was like, well, what can I do? I was like, oh, I'm going to fucking write a book about it. I just wanted to write a book about the career so people can actually understand it, because everyone knows what a cop does.
Yeah.
Everyone knows the job of a corrections officer. People think they know the job of the Border Patrol agent, but they call them border control. You know, they do all the people don't know. They think if you wear a blue uniform, it's still Border Patrol, which is not, right? They think they don't understand who ICE is in this whole narrative of the whole thing. And so all of it is piled up, and they fucking hand it off like Border Patrol is the bad guy. And it's fucked up.
What? How long did you work at Border Patrol?
Just under 7 years.
And, you know, you come from a family that two generations ago made their way across that border, right? So, like, what preconceptions did you have about that situation that became very stupid by the time you actually got there and learned some practical shit?
You know, I didn't know much about the Border Patrol as a kid growing up. Like, I would go to Mexico with my family. We'd vacation there often, and we'd see the green trucks. And then I saw the movie Coming to America with Cheech Marin, you know, and it was fucking dope, right? But I still didn't understand the gravity of, like, Mexico, America, and you have to come over here to be a citizen. It was just so removed from our conversation in our household. But I went to go visit my grandmother all the time in Canotillo, Texas, which is a border town, you know what I mean? Which is, you know, El Paso is just within the border.
Yeah.
And I didn't really put anything two and two together until I started applying for it and really, like, oh, fuck. I call mom, like, hey, grandma, how did she come across? She's like, oh, Vinny, well, it's kind of a crazy story, right? And so then I was like, oh, fuck, you know? And, you know, I never spoke Spanish. So in L.A., you know, in some group of friends that were white, I'm the beaner in the group. My Hispanic friends, I'm the fucking, they called me a fucking coconut, right? And so it was like, I never knew where I fit in that world as well, because I was either too Hispanic or not Hispanic enough. And so my whole life has been like this kind of crazy space, but I knew my grandfather served. I knew a couple uncles who served. And so it was like, oh, man, for me, joining was like, if I can do what I thought I was doing in the military is protecting our country overseas, but do it here in country, I'm still serving my country in the same patriotic fashion. So be it. Let's do it. Then I started questioning, like, well, fuck, I'm Hispanic. Then I started looking like, dude, most of them are Hispanic. Then why is that?
Yeah.
Well, our grandparents have taught us to believe in what America is. They came here for the reason of the proud opportunities of what America gives them. And so who am I to shit on their fucking belief of, like, coming here and using the opportunity to be good American citizens and provide for the country back? And so I just wanted to continue to serve that.
Yeah, there's a weird, we have a weird relationship with our own national identity now.
Yeah.
I think if you would ask myself or you when we were in high school, I make this point a lot, but what it meant to be an American, we would have an answer to that question.
Yeah.
And it would be pretty specific probably, right? And it may be, we may have different answers, but it would be, we would have one.
Yeah.
I don't know that a 14, 15-year-old now has an answer to that question. I don't know if it even occurs to them,
yeah.
which is a problem in itself, but I don't think they would have an answer. So, and I don't think that the this modern immigrant that we're seeing doesn't appear to be coming for the same reason. Like the America, the geographic features of America are not some magic. You don't come here and you're successful. That's not right. what it's like. You come here and if you the right way and you work hard, then you're successful. It's like all three of those things, right? Yeah.
The term immigrant mentality used to be a positive thing because it's like you show up here and you fucking use that opportunity and you work your ass off to provide for your family and create generational changes, like complete generational shifts. I don't know if it's the same thought process anymore because my family did that. They came here and they became very successful in their worlds. And I want to continue to do that for my kids. But nowadays it's different. It's like, they're so incentivized to come here. And my fear is, and I would say more realistically, most of the people coming across don't care about the future of what America has. They're not wanting to invest in what America can be for their own kids. Most are coming here and I've had conversations with a lot of, I want to get a job and send money back.
Yeah.
And it's like,
that's become more and more.
Right. And they're like, fuck, that's crazy to me because if you come here because we give opportunity, you should say, no, I want to continue to build this so others can have the same opportunity. It's not the same. It's a very different thought process, which then you have to look at illegal immigration in a way of like, man, it's almost using us. And that's not fair either.
Yeah. It's really interesting how we've lost our national identity to a large degree, and certainly part of that is losing pride in the country. I say this all the time, so bear with me, but British author G.K. Chesterton said that men didn't love Rome because she was great. Rome was great because men loved her, right? That's the kind of attention and care that a community needs to thrive like that. But it's interesting that as we've lost our national identity, even the people who are self-selecting to come here don't respect it anymore either. And I wonder which is the chicken and which is the egg.
Right.
You know, it's hard to say, I guess. Yeah. But I can't say this. Like, somebody's got to do something. Well, you better fucking start caring about your country. But if you want it to continue existing, like, we're in rough times right now. You may not notice it because you're eating Hot Pockets and watching shit on your iPad, but we're in pretty rough times right now.
Yeah. There's got to be a pride. When people start turning the American flag into that's a symbol of whatever else they want to call it, it's like, that's where we're starting to fuck up because that flag represents what it is to be American in all facets and all fucking countries that have come here to find success. That flag should be the identity of like, that means I could come here and find success by working my ass off. That's what that flag represents. But it's been twisted and turned so much that people are almost afraid of that flag. And younger generations are like, oh, I don't know if I want to hang the flag anymore because I don't want people to judge me and think I'm racist or any of that shit. Right? Because that's what they're starting to make people feel about it. And that's a scary thing, right? I try and raise my kids to be very patriotic in the sense like, dude, you got to love America for what it is, dude. It's giving us what we fucking have.
Yeah.
And we're only one generation apart from my mother fucking picking cotton, homeboy. Yeah, you know what I mean? Yeah, like what we have done in the time we have been in America, we've given back as much as possible. I want to continue that belief system. Mm-hmm. But this is just now I do have a lot of kids, but it's just my small imprint on this nation is hopefully that at least my kids will continue that thought process.
Yeah, Reagan said something like, liberty's always one generation away from extinction, right? It's like, fucking
I mean,
of all the stuff he said that was a little kooky and tripling the national debt, I'm not a huge fan of Reagan, to be honest. Not that it matters, but that was about the smartest thing I think he ever said in his life. Because relative safety seems so safe until it's not, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's a really crazy time right now.
Like, you lose I think this is at the crux of this, but we've lost, like, whatever biological imperatives we have that make their way into our like physiology such that it can like controls the way we think. We've lost the connection between effort and outcome at this point. It's like, just expect good things to happen. It's like, all right, cool, man. It's like, being positive is great, you know what I mean? You know, Churchill said that appeasement is feeding the crocodile hoping he eats you last. And 260 known derogatories from Afghanistan and Chechnya and then Eastern Russia, not in Chechnya and shit like that, have made their way across the border this year and have been given NTAs and sent out into the country.
Yep.
It's like, I could do a lot of stuff with 260 terrorists.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And we're seeing how Israel's actually got a border wall, right? And an Iron Dome. We don't have any of that shit.
Yeah.
And then certainly not our interior communities. They don't have any of that shit. Like we're, I really suspect that we're going to get hit sometime during the holidays. I think it'll be a follow-on action. I think that it's primed for it now. 5 million people have come across
from
the border.
From who do you think?
It'll be disparate. It'll be fucking decentralized. That's the way they operate.
Yeah.
Like they're the thing that people don't realize. the thing that people don't realize about terrorism is that this. It may seem blowing yourself up in a fucking crowded mall or shooting up a bunch of fucking kids at a school or whatever it is might seem like a new tactic, but the baseline tactic is not new, right?
Yeah.
It is to provoke, and like we have continental standoff like no other country does, right? Except for our southern and northern border. You have to draw us out of the castle to come fight you somewhere else. And as we're doing that, our homeland becomes weaker. We spend more money and resources, so we have less. And then people get fatigued by this over time and have less political will to do anything that's necessary to keep a country safe. So it isn't about knocking the towers down. It's about the Department of Homeland Security and the Patriot Act. That's what it's really about.
Yeah.
It's about creating the conditions where leaders and countries will overreach, will spend too much money, will freak out. It's basically just attacking supply lines. It's nothing new. We've been doing this since the beginning of warfare. And we're dumb enough to fall into that trap. So why would they stop now?
Yeah, man. I live in a constant like mindset of, you know, the massive influx of people coming across, right?
5 million in 2 years.
Yeah. So I live in a constant mindset of prepared. Right. Mm-hmm. I'm always prepared for that, for like some kind of terrorist action, something to happen. And I would just use my wife, for instance, she doesn't even think like that at all. So when I kind of mention it to her, I'm trying not to fear monger my own wife, but I'll say like, hey, it's kind of, you know, I'm very calm about it because like I've done the work. I'm prepared for any of this shit and fucking it is. So I always tell like, you know, the illegal immigration thing's fucked up, but the fear is what could happen from all those people that come into country. And she goes, what do you mean? I was like, well, a lot of things could happen, right? And I'm trying to like soft,
not be blow, specific,
right? Yeah. Soft blow this to her, just be like, look, we should always be thinking about this stuff, you know what I mean? And like the rest of the world, they're like, oh, you know, I've done so many podcasts about this book, and they're like, what do you think? I say the same to them because like I don't fear monger this. I'm prepared for it because there's a high probability of something like this to happen because this tactical side of my head is always like, oh shit, this is kind of crazy.
If there's any doubt, there is no doubt.
Right.
That's how you operate in combat. Right.
And so, and then the other side of the immigration side is like, you know, it's got to slow down at some point. We got to figure this out because it becomes even more so every year a bigger threat because the pooling of people that are coming here that probably don't have the same ideology as America are going to be against us.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't like the idea of, at its core, I don't like the idea of selective admission based on immutable traits, right? Like someone's ethnicity or whatever shouldn't have anything to do with it.
Right.
Nor should their religion. But there should be an ideological standard that you have to meet before you can immigrate here. Like people that are in major cities waving signs and like Palestinian flags, wave it all you want. I don't give a shit about that. Yeah. That's your political position. When you're waving a sign that is a quote that's been used for the last 100 years to say the Jews need to be wiped out, then I think you should fucking have your American citizenship revoked and thrown into the fucking ocean, frankly. Yeah. There's no room here for that kind of bullshit.
Yeah,
that's, you know what I mean? And I would feel the same. Like if there's a Klansman who think that all black people need to be fucking caged somewhere, take that motherfucker's citizenship away and throw him into the fucking ocean. Fuck him.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I feel libertarian most of the time, but when it's people subjugating other people, I get fucking mad. And maybe it's because of my, you know, upbringing, being abused when I was a kid. I get really fucking tuned up about that shit. But there's no place in our world for that. Liberty only exists if it exists for everybody and all the time. Yeah. Otherwise, it's just another form of fucking authoritarianism, right?
Yep.
I will not support that under any circumstances. We have to stop capitulating to these powers, and it isn't even out of force anymore. It's out of convenience. Yeah. Like, oh, I don't want to have to go find a new job. Just give me that shot. Or I don't want to have to do this. So just do. So I'll just wear your mask for the next 2 years. Like, yeah. Come on, man. That's who we are now. It's no surprise that we're here.
Yeah.
You know, at this point, the other thing about, you know, people in public and shit, the most powerful weapon you have is situational awareness, right? Your brain is way better at being a brain than you are at thinking. Yeah. So if you're starting to feel anxious or nervous about something, get your shit, get your kids, get the fuck out of there.
Right.
Don't fucking second guess yourself. Just do it. There's plenty of time to tell that funny story later. Like, oh, you know what? I just got spooked and left. I don't know what happened. That's a lot better than picking your kids' brains up off the fucking floor.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean?
We have contingency thoughts all day long in my house because I have to. My head has to. And she has to know what's on my mind.
Well, you've got like 30 kids now.
Right, so it's right. Like, well, I have you know, the whole Alpha, thing. Alpha and Bravo team.
Got a call-out roster and shit. give me the elevator pitch of the book. Tell me what I'm going to learn when I read this thing.
Yeah, so,
I mean, I've already read it, but tell me what I'm going
to... My goal with this book is to explain the Border Patrol career field through my eyes as the person who experienced it himself, to explain what the job entails and what the duties are of a Border Patrol agent himself, as well as a highlight of the special operations teams. I think when you read this book, you'll understand what the Border Patrol's position is with the immigration and how they handle their job, as well as I think it's going to be a very valuable recruiting tool for anyone in the military wanting to come out and do something badass. The Special Operations Unit in the Border Patrol are hands down fucking high speed as fuck and very, very good at what they do. I would never have left that career if it wasn't going through my own personal struggle in my life. Mm. You know, going through my issues with the divorce, going through becoming a single father again, all these things. And then wanting to pursue, you know, the acting side of things because the business side of my life was doing well at the time. I never would have left that career. I really wholeheartedly believe they're the first line of defense against any terrorist actions coming across that border. And what my goal was is for people to want to humanize the badge, for people to understand what they're doing and to appreciate and have gratitude for that job itself, because I think it is the most patriotic position you can have in this country by being a Border Patrol agent currently in our society. And they're not getting the credit that they deserve.
Yeah, we've had the good fortune to see some leaked meetings with Border Patrol leadership and Mayorkas as well.
Yeah.
With, you know, frontline guys saying, what the fuck, dude?
Yep.
And then being lied to openly on camera by Mayorkas and other Border Patrol leaders.
And Ortiz at the time.
Ortiz, yeah. It's like...
It's tough, man, because, you know, Ortiz said it, in which I actually really appreciate when he said this, is like, look, man, I don't agree with happening, but I have to do what his job is. At the same time, what are they going to, if he doesn't, what happens? They just fire him and find someone else. Mm. They find another puppet to speak for him. And so there's that fight with the Border Patrol themselves. They want to do the right thing. The job itself has just an innate like patriotism to the country. But, you know, they can only go as far as, you know, the Border Patrol doesn't create the policy. It's the policymakers do, the administration does. And these executive orders that come down the chain of command are out of anyone's hands. And so it's a really unfortunate position to be in, to choose a career field that you really believe in, and then to be given an executive order to not be allowed to do your job. Mm. That's a frustrating position to be. And I don't even know, like, you know, and if so, we and him are going back and forth on this kind of topic. It's like, man, I feel for them because if I didn't have a business outside of the Border Patrol, I wouldn't have been able to walk away. Yeah. And even if I just hated every part about it, I wouldn't have been able to walk away. So the one thing I did for myself was get onto the special operations team, because I feel at least I'm focused on things that are really making impacts by disrupting trafficking organizations and whatnot. And so you felt like you were still being able to accomplish a mission. But in the end of the day, the executive order takes precedence, and we have to follow that.
Well, how far do you have to follow it? Like, over the past couple of months, seeing Border Patrol agents cut C wire that was put out, I wouldn't do that. They'd have to fire me.
Yeah, well, there's the side of that is, you remember that you're just seeing that. What happens was that is the Border Patrol is under what? The federal, right? The federal kind of it makes a determination on those policies, but the state doesn't. And so what happened was state law enforcement officers put the barbed wire.
Sure.
But that barbed wire was already about 20 meters from the entry point of America. So those people, those personnel already crossed into America. They're here. So the Border Patrol always has taken a kind of a more passive approach to arrest authorities. Mm. We don't pull out a gun and say, you're under arrest. We just say, hey, párate. You know what I mean?
Why not?
Because there never has been a need for it. It's not an aggressive posture that they're taking with us. Now, if there was an aggressive posture in the sense where they're coming with a pistol, we pull our pistol. But at the end of the day, they're coming across with the demeanor as just like, hey, we're here. We're ready to get our papers. That's just the fact, right? Yeah,
but if like a, you know, let's say a yacht with 200 Chinese clearly operators pulled up to one of our ports in the Northeast somewhere, right?
Yeah.
And they were super polite when they were getting off the boat. But
if they have weapons.
No weapons.
Yeah.
But it's clearly Chinese military, right? We've seen a massive influx of military-age males into this country, especially over the past 6 months.
Right.
Right? Like, that is a passive invasion. Like, I'm not blaming Border Patrol for
this. No, I get you.
But the posture can't remain the same.
The posture will stay that posture until it's changed in an executive order or some kind of policy. That's just the problem, is like, their job is to apprehend and process and hand off to the next. If there was something put into order saying, hey, you guys need to make sure they do not come into this country, well, then the Border Patrol will take that position. But currently, the Border Patrol takes a position of exactly what's given to them. Apprehend them. And if you have to escalate, right, the use of force continuum. If someone escalates violence, then you escalate yourself. But until then, they're just coming across being like, hey, because it's incentivized as well, right? They're coming across knowing in 3 days they'll be released with an NTA, a phone, and $1,500 or whatever from these NGOs. But that's the problem, is the Border Patrol takes a passive position. And not the problem, it's just what part of their job is a humanitarian mission, right? So it is this, they got to play law enforcement officer, humanitarian mission at the same time, as well as worry about the Homeland Security and follow immigration policy at the same time. Like, it's the hardest fucking job you're ever going to have because a sheriff goes, fuck you, homie. Here's barbed wire. You ain't coming in. That's the sheriff's position. They take more of an aggressive posture, and they can, right? Yeah. That's actually their orders told to do that. That's by the state. But Border Patrol is told to do what they do, and that's why you see those things like cutting the wire. Because if they didn't cut the wire, then these people would potentially get injured, blah, blah, blah. No matter what, we're providing medical to them. It's this really hard thing, but that is the position that Border Patrol takes on that. It's like, if they're already crossed into our country and they're already making way, what's the point of letting them fucking get caught?
I want to dig a 40-foot ditch and then put crocodiles in it. What do you think about that?
I don't know if they'd allow you to do that, but
who's they?
There's some border. I'm trying to think, because someone said this before, and we were talking to the. I was actually with Border Patrol talking about that, and it's something. There's like, in a reasonable amount of like safety is still expected to be created. So like all the guys who own ranches, why don't they do that? All the guys that order ranches on the border. Like, there's fucking tons of border owned by ranchers.
I don't know. I would.
I don't know if you'd be allowed to. I don't know if you're allowed to.
What do you mean allowed, though? Who's going to stop me? It's my property.
Yeah, correct. But I don't know. Look at that. Fuck it. I don't know. Yeah, that's the truth. I don't know, but I remember.
I don't either. I remember there was
an argument about this, and there's something about it, and I can't really speak on it because I can't. I'll fuck it up. But I know there was something to the fact that by law, they wouldn't be even allowed to create that. Because, like, how many just straight up patriotic dudes own those ranches? Mm-hmm. There's nothing they can do. They just create a higher fence, they put little barbed wire on their fence, and eventually it just gets cut through by the next coyote. So, like, I know there's something that to the effect, I don't know exactly what that law is.
Maybe we should buy the land south of the border, too, right?
That'd be interesting.
Just buy an acre on each side and put crocodiles in those. I just really wanted to involve crocodiles. I don't know why. No, this is it's an insane situation.
It's fucked.
And the only way it gets fixed is by strong leadership from the top, to be honest.
Yeah, and I've tried explaining to people, like, there's no 1+1=2 aha answer. It's a 7-layer cake, and knowing the right recipe would fucking is what it's going to take, and that means multiple different angles of attack with this, from trying to figure out what's going on in that country and why they're fleeing from that country. Mm. On the same time, educating them that you know, human traffickers are fucking abusing them, and as well as like manipulating them, as well as understanding, like, you know, the drug. Like, there's so many layers of this that we have to approach. Also, how about the people that are already here? How do we, you know, what Reagan did? You know, there's things like that. All these different layers have to be addressed when you're talking about this whole immigration issue. Because if not, you're only just doing the surface level answer, and that's still never going to work. It's what every president has done for the past, like, what, 30, 40 years.
Just punt,
scrape the top. It's working, and then you realize nothing changes.
Yeah, I'm not sure that the people coming here know the deal either. Like, do you know you're going to go to a bodega for 3 weeks? And if you're a woman of any caliber, you're getting hooked on fucking drugs, and you're getting raped for a couple of weeks, and then sent out as a fucking prostitute for the rest of your life.
I don't understand That's a crazy one. There's such good communication between them, because that's how they know. Like, that's why, like, Eagle Pass is like massive. Oh, yeah. Flux.
I mean, they've got immigration attorney appointments before they even cross the
fucking
border.
It's insane, dude. Yeah, and you know, they know they're gonna get processed in 3 days in that area because there's this huge process center that does it fast, right? But how come they're not telling the females the dangers of what's gonna happen?
Yep.
It's crazy to me, dude. And there's families that are giving their kids 9 years old and up birth control just because, not if, it's when, right? So all these fucking things, like, it's fucking pretty terrible, but where's the information being spread about that? Where's the people talk? They should be calling their own people like, yo, this is not as safe as you think.
Yeah.
And it's just not, I don't know why that's not happening.
Well, maybe we can make a documentary about it.
I'm 100% down. I've been down, bro.
I know.
Trying to find someone to fucking fund that has been impossible.
Yeah, it's weird how everybody wants to talk about this issue, but nobody wants to do a goddamn thing.
I've offered to every major hitter out there, come with me to the border. I have a paper from Department of Homeland Security that says you're more than welcome to film here as long as you like tell the truth of the Border Patrol career field. Like, that's too easy. But like everything else that's going on down there, no one wants to. No one wants to touch it, bro.
It's weird.
It's odd as fuck to me, dude. I'm not using my own money. Shit, we're still on strike. I still haven't got paid in like 6 months. But it's this crazy thing that no one really wants to jump on that. I've offered, I don't even want to call names, man. I've big dudes, dude, are like, well, think about it.
Yeah.
It's a scary thing to jump on. And it's so controversial. It's so divisive. There's the crazy thing. When I post about like the illegal immigration coming across, right, I just make one video. And the shit on my feed is people talking shit back and forth, this and that. Like, there's some people like, welcome home. And there's other people like, shoot them all. And I'm like, whoa, both sides are fucking wrong. Like, I get the emotions on both sides of it. But this is such a complex issue that we just need to expose more information on it. We need to show it. And so people to understand it. Because it is, I think in the end of the day, most people would agree that somewhere in the middle is the answer, and we have to find what that answer is. Because if you don't allow immigration, well, then you almost lose the dignity of what America stands for as well.
Yeah.
And so there's a balance that has to happen there. And there's a balance in the security that has to happen. Right now, the dial is turned so far, like allowing immigration, that we're not having the security side that we need. We need to dial it back to where both parties, in the sense of parties as in security and immigration policy, are met. And where we can kind of dial back and forth as things kind of change.
Yeah, look, it's a bizarre and interesting conversation. Dichotomous for sure. I mean, I think we all want to, nobody wants to look at a kid or a family that is trying to have a better life and say no.
Right.
You know what I mean? And you're putting us into a position, not you, but, you know, the government's putting us into a position where we're going to have to say no. Machiavelli said that if you're kind when you're supposed to be cruel, you'll be forced to be cruel and you're supposed to be kind.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And that's the way
I think that's
works.
Exactly what's happening, is that people are so frustrated that now they don't even want to see the human side of it.
Yeah.
And I get that. They're so fucking mad about it. They're like, fuck all of them. And it's like, I sit here in the middle thinking like, I get that, but fuck, we can't do that either, because this country has dignity still and wants to keep that.
Yeah. Well, we should just, you know, one for one swap any family that's coming here to make a better life, they're in. Anybody that's in Tifa, they're out. Seems like a fair trade to me. Borderline Defending the Home Front by Vincent Vargas. It comes out on, what, the 14th?
Yeah, the 14th.
14th, so right after Veterans Day. Thanks for coming today, man. I appreciate it.
No, thank you for the conversation, man.
Yep, anytime. And thank you all for listening. This has been Citizen.